And we will move on to our third case for this morning, United States against Rahman. Mr. Albee.
When Milwaukee Police Detective Elizabeth Wallach asked Firas Rahman for consent to search his restaurant, she could have asked for permission to conduct a full-blown search of the premises. But she did not. Instead, she asked for a narrow consent that was limited to the cause and origin of the search. To obtain this consent, she used a pre-printed form that was prepared just for these types of situations. And that pre-printed form mirrored what would be permitted for investigators to search under an administrative warrant. Clifford and other cases show that an administrative warrant may allow a search for cause and origin. They do not allow a search for criminal responsibility. That requires probable cause and a probable cause search warrant if the investigators are going to look for evidence of criminal responsibility.
And going further on, quoting Clifford, it says, some fires may be so devastating that no reasonable privacy interests remain. The ash and the ruins, regardless of the owner's subjective expectations. Under a trespass theory, is there any time when the fire damage is so great there's no Fourth Amendment violation for searching? And wouldn't that apply here?
I don't believe there would be that situation. I guess I haven't thought through it. In this case, the basement and the effects are still there. Mr. Rahman has asked for consent because they realize he has permission. He has the authority to exclude people from that premises. He still has his effects. I don't think in any way the fact that he has the misfortune of being a victim of a fire, anybody would foresee that allows them to tread through your premises and look through the effects that are still there. The basement is not damaged by fire at all.
So you're distinguishing, as the magistrate judge did, between the complete ruin of the ground floor and the upper floors on the one side, and the fact that although there's water in the basement, his office, his papers, his other personal things are still undamaged in the basement.
I guess under the particular facts of this case, I'm mostly concerned about the basement. I do believe that under the trespass theory, Mr. Rahman has standing to complain about what happens on the first floor as well.
But there's no, but you're not really complaining about any evidence they find in the first floor.
That's right.
Well, these pictures that you give, didn't the top kind of cave in on the basement?
No.
So this isn't.
That's the second floor falling into the first floor, Your Honor.
But somewhere else other than?
Not in the basement. There's no collapse into the basement.
Okay. Thanks.
And in assessing the legality of the actions of the investigators in this case, it's important to consider both the timing and the location of the searches. On day one, the fire is extinguished. By day two, they know that the origin of the fire is in the Black and White Cafe, or perhaps it began in the area directly above it. And they also know that there's been no fire in the basement, that wasn't where the fire started, and they don't have any reason to believe that it was caused there either. Yet on day four, numerous investigators are in that basement where they know the fire didn't start. They're not searching for the origin of the fire. They're not searching for the cause. What they're doing by conducting a line search and then a second line search and opening up bank bags in the office and looking through his cash register and gathering whatever papers they can find and looking at those, what they're doing there is looking for criminal responsibility. They're looking for motive. They're looking for whether Mr. Rahman lied to them, and they're looking for whether there's evidence of arson.
Right. So I want to be clear I can understand the distinction you're drawing, because it seems to me that a cause and origin search would certainly allow the police to go down to the basement, let's say, and check the alarm box to see, you know, when did the alarm go off, to check, you know, to make sure there wasn't an electrical short, to check, you know, make sure that the gas didn't blow up, you know, I mean, whatever, you know, things might cause a fire. And I would think once they're legitimately in the basement for those purposes, they would also be entitled to look at anything that's in plain view. So I'm trying to see what's the principal line you're trying to draw. And maybe it's opening bags or reading books or searching drawers or, you know, where does the line fall? Because it strikes me in a building like this, there could well be relevant evidence in the basement for cause and origin.
I would agree that a once through in the basement, which is all that would have been required in this case, to look, for example, for structural damage. I mean, certainly it would be reasonable for them to make sure it's safe to be on the first floor by going through the basement. Certainly, if there was something that, you know, to take a look if there was something that was electrical or something like that. But they didn't see any of those things. And there's no testimony in this record that they were looking for any of those things when they were down there on day four, when they were looking in bank bags and conducting these line searches. And it's only through conducting the line searches that they can give their testimony of, we don't believe there's a computer or a safe in those in that area. None of those things could have caused the fire. What they were looking for, again, was evidence of motive, whether Mr. Rahman had lied to them, whether they could connect him to...
So your feeling is if they had seen a laptop computer sitting on his desk down in the basement, what they would have had to do is go get a warrant before they could open up that computer and search it for signs of, you know, arson activity.
Absolutely. That kind of personal effect. There's nothing about the consent in this case for the cause and origin of the fire that would allow them to delve into his personal things like a computer. If they had probable cause that that might contain evidence, absolutely. It's either get further consent or get a search warrant based on probable cause. Those are their options.
So let me ask you this. How important is this search issue to your other argument that the evidence was simply insufficient to support the finding of lying to the investigators about the computer?
I think it's very important in the sense that they would not have the foundation to claim that there was no computer on the premises if they hadn't conducted these searches that went far beyond the cause and origin of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way in the response brief of the government, they call the failure to ask follow-up questions and pin Mr. Rahman down as to what the computer looked like or how many computers he might have had or where exactly those computers would most likely be. The failure to ask those, they term as unfortunate, but you can't assume what he meant when he just makes a statement as, I have a computer with business records, given that many of us have more than one computer, and there's
it's
no...
It's so weird to me, because they actually find the computer that they think he was talking about in his home. You know, we've got the picture of the Gateway laptop. And I presume they did do a forensic analysis of that computer, because that's where they find out that he's contacted the real estate agent, and that's where they pick up the Google Maps, Google Earth search. So I presume that this forensic examination does not turn up any deleted files of business records or anything like that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So in a sense, here's this computer that doesn't match the description of what he says he had in the business anyway. It's not a business records computer.
The only description that he arguably gave of the computer is that it's the one with business records. They didn't find that computer. So and at the time of the questioning, they weren't asking about any particular computer. They didn't have any assumptions that the computer would be this computer, or a red one, or a black one, or a gray one. And that's why, you know, they didn't follow up, so that we'll never know what computer he was talking about at that time.
Now, is it your theory that if the computer had been on the first floor, it's conceivable that this shoveling operation for the first floor might have missed it?
I think there's no way they ever would have found it. There are two tenants directly above the Black and White Cafe. Their belongings all fell into the lower level. No computers were found. What we'd be looking for would be this charred motherboard. You can see from the pictures just the extent of the debris that is all over the place. It really is a needle in the haystack kind of situation. I'd also note that at the evidentiary hearing, Agent Hankins identified some plywood as the floor of the second floor, And I said, well, couldn't that be the roof? And he said, yeah, I guess it could. I mean, it's just, I'm not complaining about Agent Hankins, but it just highlights the difficulties of determining what's on the first floor, what's the second floor. And there also was a radiator that was at the very bottom of the rubble, and that came from the second floor. So there really wasn't a way to distinguish between those two.
So did Mr. Rahman offer any theory as to why he did remove the Gateway laptop from Black and White Cafe?
As the court knows, he didn't testify in this case.
So there's no indirect theory either?
No.
And so, I mean, the problem that Mr. Rahman has, he tells some lies. He lies about his friend Ihsan Atta, for example. So do we have any theory about that?
Well, I argued in the closing argument that I think that's the concern that it's certainly conceivable that the concern would be he would not get his insurance money if he didn't have receipts for all the work that had been put into this place. There's no dispute that tens of thousands of dollars of work was done converting it from the old restaurant to the new restaurant. And so, you know, whether that's what's going on or not, again, there's no evidence in this record. I also, I guess, going back to the earlier question, I certainly don't think it's unusual for somebody to take a computer home. I mean, that's why we have laptops that are portable. So I don't, you know, the government painted that as atypical, but I think we all do things that would be deemed atypical in any given day. The other sufficiency of the evidence argument that has been raised deals with the failure to prove the ATF's jurisdiction. And in the government's response, I think it just exposes the fact that they haven't, they did not introduce that evidence because they cite to the evidentiary hearing in an effort to show that they had established jurisdiction rather than some point in the trial transcript. I think that just exposes that they completely failed to present any testimony about why ATF would have jurisdiction over this type of fire.
But it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, it's a fire that eventually sweeps through four restaurants, their businesses under the Supreme Court's decisions, federal jurisdiction is implicated.
I think it would be obvious to the government. I think it would be obvious to the court. I don't think it would be obvious to the jury, and they're the ones who need to receive that evidence in order to make that finding. No reasonable jury could make that finding based on the evidence because there was none in this case. There's a second problem, which is that the only evidence that was introduced was the statement was made to a state investigator rather than an ATF agent. And at that time, there were parallel investigations, but no federal oversight over what the state was doing. Later on, there was that federal oversight, but at the time of the statement, there was not. And so I think for that reason as well, the evidence was insufficient. So, yes, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Watzke.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kelly Watzke, and I represent the United States in this matter. The defendant has raised many issues on appeal, which I hope have been adequately addressed in the government's brief. I'd like to begin this morning by addressing the issue related to the search and the scope of the investigator's actions. I think that the defense argument regarding the scope of the search essentially rises and falls on a mistaken belief that this search was akin to the types of limited administrative searches that occurred pursuant to administrative warrant authority, as was the case in Michigan v. Clifford and all the other cases cited by the defendant. But none of those cases are particularly relevant here because this was a consent search.
Well, but it was a consent that was limited to cause and origin. That's the problem I have. Here's my issue with the government's theory. If you really think that that document that Mr. Rahman executed was actually consent to search anything that might shed light on whether there was arson, on anything else, then I don't see why the government couldn't have gone to his home, rooted through his personal effects, rummaged through his car, looked at everything. I mean, that there is a tradition of cause and origin searches, and that's what this warrant is. I mean, you don't just have cause and origin searches when there's an administrative warrant.
I disagree, Your Honor. I don't think that this is in any way akin to an administrative warrant. And it's irrelevant that those terms, cause and origin, have a special meaning in the context of a statute or some administrative provision. Consent searches, which is what this was, regardless of the terminology that was used, that was filled in by the detective in this case, are judged, the scope of which are judged, by what an ordinary citizen sitting in the shoes of Mr. Rahman would have reasonably and objectively interpreted those words to mean. And here, the detective sat down with Mr. Rahman at a booth at a McDonald's, just like all the other business owners were addressed, and said, here's a consent form, and this is for us to search for cause and origin.
To determine the origin and cause of this fire.
And find out what happened.
Well, that's not what it says. I'm looking at it. It's here at separate appendix, page 2.
That's what the detective testified she said to Mr. Rahman, and that was uncontroverted at the evidentiary hearing. And
but see, you have to deal with the paper and what was said, and you said the common sense meaning. That determine the cause and origin of the fire. I mean, it wasn't what you added was, and what happened.
No, that's what the detective added when she was explaining
exactly.
it to Mr. Rahman.
But what I'm saying, that makes it a lot broader. Say what happened, but what he signed didn't have it. Didn't.
So you need that extra. I think you really need that.
I disagree with that, but I think it helps certainly.
Well, I don't know.
I don't agree. And see, Hankins knew the fire didn't originate in the basement. He knew that. So that's
not accurate, Your Honor. At the time that they obtained the consent from Mr. Rahman, that is not an accurate statement.
Once they find out, though, they go down to the basement. They see other than the water damage. It's relatively unaffected. It hasn't burned up all the papers in the office. It hasn't, I mean, these unbelievable photographs at the beginning of the appendix, you know, showing what a mess it was above. This is a consent to search the residence to determine the origin and cause of the fire. And if you think origin and cause means everything, then you've even changed Clifford. You've even changed administrative searches. And I think that's
That's not the government's position here. I don't think this case, on these facts, in any way affects Clifford, because Clifford did not involve consent.
Yeah, well, let me just go a little further. It's true, they didn't know for sure it was arson or not arson.
But when they
went downstairs, the things they looked for to determine if it's arson was there an electrical malfunction? Was there a flame to accelerant? Was there a gas leak? All these things that go to sort of the cause and origin of the fire. Was there some hot spot? Was there whatever? So, but once they get down there, they rule that out. That's the end game.
They did not rule that out at that point. I think the sequencing is very important here.
I want to just come back and say that you are making a jump from the fact that something is an administrative warrant, namely the type of warrant, to a scope issue, and I don't think that's a justified leap. A warrant is one way that you can look at cause and origin. Consent is another way to look at cause and origin. A warrant might be for the whole place, for all sorts of criminal activity specified in the warrant. Consent might be for the whole place, no matter what. But those are two separate things. What kind of an instrument is justifying the search and the scope of the search? And I really am troubled by the notion that as soon as it says consent at the top of the page, there are no limits,
even if there
are limits.
Right, and the limits were a task force, which is what was filled in the blank, has the authority to search the black and the white
cause and origin, and that's it,
of the fire that occurred on January 19th through January 30th.
And that's
what happened here.
No. They start rummaging through his bank bags. That's not cause and origin search.
If you're defining that term by the terms of what some statute says, then I guess you're right. But I don't think that that's what this is.
Well, I'm looking at Clifford is what I'm looking at.
I don't think Clifford applies here. I don't think it applies at all.
See, there's your blending.
I really don't. I mean, but let's put aside our disagreement, because I also disagree with the conclusion you're drawing about what it was that they were doing in the basement. The sequencing is really important here. They obtained consent on the morning that the fire is still burning, January 19th. Cause and origin are not even, they're not at a probable cause standard until midday on January 23rd.
Nobody's talking about probable cause. What made the fire happen is they haven't even made a determination about cause or origin
until midday on January 23rd.
Right. And I'm saying when they're searching for cause and origin, they're saying what made the fire spring up? You know, what caused the fire? Did somebody light a match? Right. You know, was there an electrical short? What caused this fire, and where did it start? Did it start on the first floor of the Black and White Cafe? Did it start next door at the Grecian Delight? Did it start upstairs because a tenant was smoking in bed? You
right.
know, what happened?
All of those theories were in play up until the 23rd. And Agent Hankins testified at length at the evidentiary hearing, and the magistrate credited his testimony as reasonable and reliable. He offered numerous reasons why the search of the basement would help him assess not only the origin, the location of the fire, but also its cause.
Might mean what's inside Mr. Rahman's brain, but cause might also mean which box does this fire belong in. And if we decide it belongs in the arson box, which, by the way, of course, the jury rejects, but we'll put that to one side. If we decide it belongs in the arson box, then we need a criminal investigation. So we'll go to the magistrate, we'll get a warrant, we'll investigate.
Again, I respectfully disagree. That is only if we're talking about a limited administrative search.
Okay.
And
so
origin and cause includes intentionally set fires. I believe that this consent form was a broad consent form that authorized investigators to look for both signs of accidental and intentional fire.
So you don't think there would ever be any reason for a warrant for this house? You think this was something that could have justified, you know, opening his diaries, reading everything he said, that this was, as far as you're concerned, a general warrant for the house, for the restaurant?
Look, I think
there are no limits
in
your
theory.
No, that's
not accurate. I think as long as there's evidence of record, and here there was, that the agent articulated, there's a reason for them to look for things. And really, what we're talking about...
No, I don't understand that distinction at all.
What is the limit? What are you saying the limit is? Because as far as I can understand your argument, there is no limit. Once you get that cause and origin warrant, you can just go down there and look at everything.
As long as the agent can articulate a reason why it could relate to the issue of origin and cause, I think that's correct. And what we're talking about in this...
No, there's no limit to what they can look at. They can look at every crack, every record, every drawer, every document.
That's your position, right?
That is your position. And if it's not your position, then I have no idea where you're drawing the line short of that.
Well, I'll draw the line as to what happened here.
Give me a principle, because I can't write an opinion for this case. I have to have a principle.
Well, the principle is, under looking at the encounter, the law of the circuit is looking at the counter between the detective and the citizen. What would the ordinary person think the words exchanged and the form meant? What would be reasonably objectable? What would they expect to be searched? When the words say, I consent... We're not looking at this from the perspective of what a detective might have believed. We're looking at it from what an ordinary citizen might have believed.
Well, that is exactly the point. And I, again, come back to this warrant on page 8. Whatever it is, I'm losing it. And I keep seeing cause and origin.
But you're looking at that through the lens of a case that interpreted specific words used in a specific statutory context I don't think applies to the average ordinary citizen's view of what it means to determine origin and cause. You're looking at it through a different lens than what the average citizen would mean.
How do I know?
And that's what the detective explained. We're here to find out what happened with this fire, where the fire started, and what happened here. I don't think it could be any simpler than that.
Let me just back up. I think we certainly have your view on this. I mean, this is a difficult case because we have the issues with the warrant. We have, secondarily, this computer that turns out not to have the business records, even with a pretty sophisticated forensic analysis, the materiality of which is baffling to me. So you get this one conviction on false statement for something that may actually have nothing to do with anything. And thirdly, you have the sentence enhanced, as is permissible under Watts. I don't disagree with that. But the evidence that this man committed arson is extraordinarily weak. It's not at all surprising to me that the jury acquitted on that ground, and it's very difficult to see why the district judge thought it was even proven by a preponderance. And if he erred on that, then the sentence looks different.
Okay, and obviously I disagree with the court, but let's talk a little bit about the computer since you raised it. The computer was very material, not just to the count four, which is
a
the
Google Earth search?
No, the computer, the lie about the computer, and importantly...
Why is that important to anything?
It's removal. Its removal from the business was highly important, and that's
why?
What the district court found. Because the evidence of record was...
A computer that isn't even the computer that he's talking about.
I don't think that's accurate. I think the indictment alleged that he lied about the existence of the computer and the fact that it contained business records. The evidence at trial was this guy didn't keep business records.
What if he lied about who his girlfriend was? I mean, he could have lied about all sorts of things that really don't shed any light on whether there was arson.
The reason why the removal of the computer was so critical is because the evidence demonstrated he didn't bring it out. He never brought it out of that restaurant. He kept it in his business. He used it as his business.
How do you know that? What's your proof of that?
We've got testimony from Ms. Felling, his girlfriend. We've got the forensic examination.
But she also testifies that there's a clunky old second computer that's not good enough to connect to the Internet well.
Which is inconsistent with her statements following the fire to law enforcement. And even if she was telling the truth, which we argued she wasn't, that computer would have been found. They didn't find any computers in the basement. The basement contents were intact. She says it's an old
she was frame. Let me just get this straight. She was your witness. You called her, right?
We did.
And you're saying she was lying, too?
Yes. She went south in every possible way. She not only contradicted herself on that computer, she contradicted herself in many ways about the defendant's actions, both at the time of the fire and afterwards. No doubt about it. We argued to the jury that Ms. Felling was not credible, and that she had strong feelings, obviously, for the defendant. She catered her testimony. But getting back to this issue...
Why did you drop the ball on Mr. Karabelos? I mean, that just is mystifying, since he's at... Shortly before the fire starts, he and some other people are seen at the scene. Your own witness testifies that sometimes arsonists will set fire an adjoining premise so that they'll deflect suspicion from themselves. If there are other people involved, we can see how the freezer and the patio furniture get moved. I think it's a very strange oversight.
Well, I don't think it was an oversight. I think that, you know, one of the most critical things that led to investigators focusing on Mr. Rahman were the many, many, many lies that he told, not just the two lies that were charged. He lied multiple times throughout the investigation of this case, and the conclusion was there was no reason for him to do so unless he was trying to cover up his own actions.
But
and the reason why the lie
indirect conclusion.
The reason why the lie about the computer was so significant is it signaled his knowledge that the fire was coming and he wanted to save it from the fire. You know, every witness that had not, first of all, he never testified there was some other, you know, computer.
And you had this weird theory that he, you know, went down to get his 80 pounds of chicken, which he did go down to the Restaurant Depot. You didn't even catch him out on a lie on that.
No, we think he did. But
he did.
I think
well,
was,
you know he did,
yeah,
because the receipts are there.
What's significant about that is earlier that day, Monday is his regular day that the Reinhardt food guy comes and goes through his whole inventory with him and places his regular standing order for 80 pounds of chicken. So those were to be delivered. Had he not done his regular standing order, that would have been very suspicious. So then later that same day, and the testimony of his employee, Mr. Hamdan, is this is a slow Monday. And Mondays in general are slow, but this one was particularly slow. So he's got this order placed, and then he comes up with this reason why, oh, I need to go get some more chicken, even though there's chicken coming the next morning. He had it was his practice, and he's told investigators that he drives his cook, Silvano, to work every morning. He could not have come to work with gasoline, for example, in his car. The chicken wing run was a reason for him to get out of the business because he was otherwise tethered to this business. And calling
you
Mr. Hamdan in...
You have all these theories about him, but none about the glaring problems that Mr. Karabelos has.
His
insurance wasn't even enough to cover, you know...
You're right, and he had not... At the time, he could not have been more unprepared for this
so he suddenly torches this business that is earning money for him, $6,000 a month, even in the slow time. It's just, it's a strained, weak case, and that's why the jury rejects it.
Obviously, I disagree, and the district court disagrees.
Well, the jury didn't disagree
and
with that.
And we're here to determine, I mean, in terms of the district court's ultimate decision here, the issue isn't whether your view of the evidence would cause you to reach the opposite conclusion.
It's a clear error standard.
It's one single mistake that the district court made about this locking mechanism would change the outcome here. It doesn't matter.
It's also a clear error determination. Obviously, why would we bother to have appeals if there was nothing to do? Then we could
But the only error that the defendant can point to at sentencing is that one, and it makes no difference.
But it's a big one because it has everything to do with opportunity to be in the right place at the right time.
I disagree. That came up in the context is really important here, and to suggest that the locking mechanism on the back door was the single most important factor that led him to conclude that Rahman's the guy is simply not accurate. The district court...
I've asked you a lot of questions, so I will, in fact, let you wrap up, but we do need to wrap up.
Okay. The district court articulates six or seven reasons why Mr. Caraballes is not, in his view, the arsonist, as argued, only one of which relates to this locking mechanism. The district court was in a position to assess his physical attributes, his demeanor, his credibility when he denied committing the arson, but most significantly, the district court found that regardless of how Mr. Caraballes could have theoretically exited the cafe after purportedly starting the fire, he could not have accomplished what had to happen next.
But there was an accomplice. There were people with him.
That's not accurate.
Two people left the building. Either two or three people left the building at 3:15 in the morning.
That's right. And
very
they
shortly.
Driving away. And no one else.
And they could have come back. And somebody else could still have been inside. I mean, the government doesn't investigate any of these things.
The people are consistent with what Mr. Caraballes reported to law enforcement. And they are, and the evidence established that when people entered or exited the Grecian Delight, which is Caraballes' restaurant, they went through the front door. And video does not show anybody going back into that restaurant closer in time to the time of the explosion. And a gas explosion isn't something that, you know, lingers and then it happens after everybody leaves. It's flame to gas, boom. You know, this was something that, and it also ignores the fact that Valerie Jones, who is the occupant upstairs, says she hears footsteps and commotion following the explosion. So this
okay,
was
okay. We're good with that.
Okay.
So I
just would like to point to the court. You know, again, there are eight reasons why the district court says it finds Rahman was
okay,
responsible,
no,
having
we know
nothing
that.
To do with the lock.
All right. So obviously, the government would like us to affirm.
Yes,
so
that's right.
We get that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Albee?
I don't have anything further unless the court has additional questions.
Could you just add a little bit about, because it's the district court finding opposite what the jury found, and you spend a lot of time in the brief on that, and it seems that's my concern, and I want to hear just your point of view. She didn't argue with that one, but
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why that the judge was wrong?
As to finding by a preponderance.
Yes.
The judge found that you would need a key to get out the back door from the inside. That is, his view is that if Mr. Caraballes had entered this connecting door in the basement, he would not have been able to get out the back door because he needed a key to get out that door. In fact, as you'd expect, you don't need a key to leave from the inside.
So a deadbolt lock that you would unlock from the inside with just a lever?
That's correct. So anybody could open that locked door, go out, and he could come back in his own back door.
So how do they get in the first place?
From the connecting door in the basement, where on his side, from Mr. Caraballes' side, all he had to do there was turn a deadbolt lock. You could not go from the black and white into the Grecian Delight without a key. But Mr. Caraballes, all he needed to do was turn a deadbolt lock.
That was the stuff that was in the way?
We don't really have much of a description about how it was in the way. They said when they went back through that they had to push some things out of the way that could, I think, easily just be put back by either an accomplice or by Mr. Caraballes himself. If there's nothing further, we would ask the court to vacate the conviction on sufficiency of the evidence ground or remand for a new trial based on the evidence should have been suppressed.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.